So as I said, we've come to the end of a series of talks. We started off back in January with a talk on Avalokiteshvara. So we had Avalokiteshvara, Manjugosha, and Vajrapani, who are usually associated with compassion, wisdom, and energy, which are the qualities taken to their ultimate, which constitute awakening or enlightenment. And then we had Green Tara, the quintessence of compassion, and followed by Amitabha, the Buddha of love, the red Buddha, followed by Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha. And then we had Padmavajra came and gave us a talk on Padmasambhava. Padmasambhava, a great Tibetan, well, he was Indian, a teacher who took Buddhism to Tibet, who's got a very rich symbolism and literature. So we had 2 weeks on that, Padmavajra, and then a puja last week led by Vidyasakhi. So now we come to the last of the mantras at the end of the puja, the Prajna Paramita mantra. Gate, gate, paragate, parasangate, bodhisvaha. Now this is not the mantra of Prajna Paramita, the Bodhisattva. She's got another mantra, which we'll hear later on in the puja. So in a way, this mantra is more associated with the Perfection of Wisdom texts, the Prajna Paramita texts. But I'll be saying something about the texts, and I'll be saying a little bit about the goddess. One thing I've been saying to people as I've been thinking about the Perfection of Wisdom this last week or two, I've been saying to some people, it's like trying to hold on to a wet bar of soap. The more you try to hold it, the more likely it is to get out of your hand, as it were. And interestingly enough, I just came across this verse which says, no wisdom can we get hold of, no highest perfection, no bodhisattva, no thought of enlightenment either. When told of this, if not bewildered and in no way anxious, a bodhisattva courses in the well-gone's wisdom. So that's kind of what I've been experiencing. Nothing to get hold of. But this is the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 lines. And the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 lines is a prose text. And all of it is also in a verse form, which is known as the Ratnaguna Sanchaya Gatha. And it begins like this. Call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. Remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. Listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, taught for the weal of the world, for heroic spirits intended. So that's how the teaching of the Ratnaguna Sanchaya Gatha begins. And this text, the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 lines, it's one of about 35 Perfection of Wisdom texts. And this verse is important because it tells us how to approach the whole topic of perfect wisdom. In fact, it tells us how to approach the whole topic of Dharma, how to approach our study and practice of Buddhism. Call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. So it's asking us to cultivate an attitude of receptivity and to purify ourselves. So if we want to really engage with the Dharma, if we want to really engage with the Perfection of Wisdom, to start with, we need to cultivate this attitude of receptivity and purify ourselves. So that applies when we're engaging in study, when we're engaging in reading, in discussion, or even listening to talks. Yeah? Call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. Yeah? So the love, the respect and the faith. They're already there. That's what he's saying. They're already there. You've already got the love, the respect and the faith. That's why you can call it forth. Yeah? You just need to contact it and bring it to bear in the situation. So you already love the Dharma. You already respect its profundity. You already have faith in its effectiveness. That's why you're practicing the Dharma. In a way, that's why you're here tonight. Yeah. So it's not like a huge demand, this call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. It's just a reminder that this is something you already have, and you just need to be in touch with it. Yeah? It says you need to contact as much as you can. Yeah. So it's not even saying you have to be perfect, just as much as you can. Call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. And that's what constitutes your receptivity. And when you can contact receptivity, when you're receptive, then you can gain much more from the Dharma than if you're in a state of doubt or a state of cynicism or something like that. So that's the first thing, to be as receptive as possible, to open your heart to the Dharma. So what you're really calling forth is positive emotion. So you don't need to be a great scholar, yeah, to encounter the perfection of wisdom. You don't need to have a master's degree. You don't need to be highly intelligent. You don't even need to be literate. But you do need to have sufficient positive emotion to listen to the Dharma. So your heart needs to be open to allow the Dharma to enter. And for this to happen, you need to purify yourself of unskillful mental states. So if you're in a state of ill will or anger or neurotic craving or whatever, you need to at least be aware of it and, if possible, try to put it to one side while engaging with the Dharma teaching. I think even better is to prepare yourself before study or before listening to the Dharma, before reading a text or anything like that, by meditating, yeah? By trying to transform any negative emotions. And when you're prepared, then you can listen to the wisdom of the gentle Buddhas. Yeah? You can really listen. You can listen not just with your ears, but with your heart. Yeah? So this is the advice of the gentle Buddhas, the compassionate Buddhas who want to help you to overcome all suffering. They teach the Dharma for the welfare of the world, for the weal of the world, as it says in the text. So really what this is about is what we already know. It's ethics, meditation, and wisdom. That's what it's about. That's what it's saying. So contact your faith. You need faith in order to practice ethics and meditation. And then remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. That's ethics and meditation. That's what they're talking about. And then the wisdom part is, initially, it's listening to the Dharma. We have that listening, reflecting, meditating. Suttamaya Prajna, Chintamaya Prajna, and Bhavanamaya Prajna. So listening, reflecting, and meditating. And finally, the verse says, this perfect wisdom, this Prajnaparamita, is for heroic spirits intended. So the Dharma changes people. It affects every aspect of your life. No corner is left untouched. And that can be a frightening prospect. It can make us feel a bit insecure. Is there not something that we can hold on to? Something that can stay unchanged? There isn't. And that's why we need courage to really listen to and engage with the Dharma. We have to be prepared, in a way, for anything to happen. We have to be prepared to make perhaps unpalatable discoveries about ourselves. We have to be prepared to have our cherished views and opinions shattered, or at least challenged. We have to be prepared to discover that we're much bigger and much more capable than we think we are. For me, that was the main thing I had to be open to when I encountered the Dharma. I found that very difficult to be open to, that actually there was more to me than I thought. I preferred being small at the time. And we have to be prepared to live by values that the world may ridicule. We have to be prepared to upset people by not living our lives in the way that they want us to. So we have to be prepared for radical change in every area of our lives. We have to be prepared for that ego-destroying explosion of perfect wisdom. And that's why the Dharma is for heroic spirits intended. So what is the perfection of wisdom? The Prajna Paramita. Well, on one level, it's a whole body of literature. Yeah, as I said, it's about 35 texts. And perhaps the most well-known Prajna Paramita texts are the Heart Sutra and the Diamond Sutra. And there's also the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines and the Ratnagun Sanchayagata. And there are a whole lot of other texts ranging from the Perfection of Wisdom in 100,000 Lines to the Perfection of Wisdom in one letter. And it's all been translated into English, all of the Perfection of Wisdom literature. And it's all been translated into English due to the efforts of one person, Dr. Edward Kunze, the German scholar. So we have a lot to be grateful for to Dr. Kunze. And the main characteristic of the Prajnaparamita literature is that it's totally non-rational. It consists of paradox after paradox, and it's most frustrating to the rational mind, most frustrating. And that is its intention. It's intended to be frustrating. It's an all-out attack on literalism. Yeah? It sets out to destroy all conceptualization and to thwart the rational mind at every time. And your rational mind will get angry with the Perfection of Wisdom or dismiss it as rubbish if you really engage with it. I remember this happening to me. I was studying one time the Sutra of Hui Neng, which is not part of that Prajnaparamita literature, but it's very similar in content. And I was studying this on an order convention, and I remember trying to read it before the study and just getting angry with it, really frustrated with it, because it's so, well, it's that thing, the more you try to grasp it, the more it just slips out of your hand. You can't, as it were, get your head around it, yeah? And I didn't like the fact that I couldn't get my head around it. It makes you feel stupid, yeah? It makes you feel stupid. And that, of course, is another reason why we need to call forth as much as we can of love, of respect, and of faith before we engage with it. The Diamond Sutra was the first ever printed book, printed in China. And it seems quite fitting to me that the first text ever printed was probably the highest teaching known to humankind. And it was on hearing the Diamond Sutra being recited that Hui Neng became enlightened. He gained enlightenment. He heard it in the marketplace. Hui Neng was illiterate. He couldn't read. And he heard in the marketplace somebody reciting the Diamond Sutra. And he got it immediately. And he became the sixth patriarch of the Zen or the Chan tradition. So the Diamond Sutra awakened him to the nature of reality. And it was the Diamond Sutra and the Sutra of Hui Neng, which Bhante Sangharakshita read at the age of 16. And he too experienced an awakening when he read those sutras. What he says in his memoirs is, "When I read the Diamond Sutra, I knew that I was a Buddhist. Though this book epitomizes teaching of such rarefied sublimity that even arahants are said to become confused and afraid when they hear it for the first time, I at once joyfully embraced it with an unqualified acceptance and assent. To me, the Diamond Sutra was not new. I had known it and believed it and realized it ages before. And the reading of the sutra, as it were, awoke me to the existence of something I'd forgotten." So we in the Tri Ratna order and the community, we can be very grateful to the perfection of wisdom, and especially to the Diamond Sutra, because our whole order and movement is part of the unfolding of that realization that Bhante had when he read the Diamond Sutra at the age of 16. So we're the spiritual children of the perfection of wisdom. Bet you didn't know that. Spiritual child of the perfection of wisdom. So the Heart Sutra contains the essence of the perfection of wisdom teachings, the essence of the Prajna Paramita teachings. And that's why it's called the Heart Sutra. It's the heart of the Prajna Paramita. And the Heart Sutra is a teaching on shunyata. It expresses an insight into shunyata. In fact, the whole of the Prajna Paramita literature is all about shunyata. So I'll say something more about shunyata later on. So Sangharakshita has done a commentary on the Heart Sutra. And he said that the Heart Sutra consists essentially of six statements. So I'm going to just look at those briefly, those six statements. It's a dialogue, of course, between the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara and Shariputra. And Avalokiteshvara is the Bodhisattva of compassion, which in a way is a little bit odd from one point of view, because you've got the Bodhisattva of compassion delivering this wisdom teaching. Yeah. But what that's, you could say what that's signifying is that actually compassion and wisdom are not separate, they're not different. And in a way, it's calling on us to reflect on the essential unity of wisdom and compassion. So Sariputra was one of the chief disciples of the historical Buddha. So he was noted for his wisdom. In the Pali Canon, in the texts of the Pali Canon, Sariputra is noted for his wisdom. In the later sutras, the Mahayana sutras, Sariputra is often made to represent the degeneration and rigidity of scholastic Buddhism. Yeah? So here he represents, in the Heart Sutra, he represents a lesser kind of wisdom. Yeah? He represents a kind of intellectual wisdom or a literalistic wisdom. And Avalokiteshvara represents the wisdom of the enlightened mind, the wisdom of the awakened mind, the wisdom of direct experience of reality. There's some parallels here, I think, with the story of Padmasambhava, because in the story of Padmasambhava you have Shantarakshita, who goes to Tibet to bring Buddhism to Tibet, to build the Samyaling monastery. But he encounters the local deities, as it were, the forces of the land of Tibet, and he can't really bring Buddhism there. So they send for Padmasambhava. And Padmasambhava, as it were, embodies this higher wisdom. Shantarakshita embodied, as it were, the lower wisdom, the intellectual. He knew his Buddhism very well. He knew all his lists, and he was someone who could teach about Buddhism, but he didn't embody it in the way that Padmasambhava did. So there is a kind of parallel between Shantarakshita and Padmasambhava and Sariputra and Avalokiteshvara in this sutra. And in this conversation in the Heart Sutra, Sariputra, the lesser wisdom, as it were, has nothing to say. So it's a strange dialogue. He's got nothing to say. He doesn't say a thing. You could say, in the face of the wisdom of the awakened mind, all the lower wisdom is rendered mute. Yeah, it's irrelevant anyway. So in the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara makes six statements. And the first statement is that the five skandhas are empty. The five skandhas are the basic constituents of all existence, whether things or people. And this statement is saying that there's nothing behind them or beyond them. No soul, no self. You know? Everything is included in the five skandhas. Material form, feelings, perceptions, volitions, and consciousness. So there's nothing else in the universe apart from these. Nothing independent of them. So they're empty of any self or soul. And the second statement is that all dharmas are empty. Sarva dharma shunyata. All dharmas are empty. So, a little bit of explanation. The Abhidharma tradition of Buddhism, which is a more intellectual, analytical tradition, it compiled a huge, complex kind of classification of all existence, breaking everything down into ever smaller units. And eventually they arrived at what they thought of as the basic units of existence, the irreducible elements that couldn't be broken down any smaller anymore. And these units or elements, they're called dharmas. Yeah? So this word dharma has many, many meanings, but in this context it has a very specific meaning about the smallest units of existence as well. So when Avalokiteshvara says all dharmas are empty, he's dismissing this whole vast compilation of the Abhidharma. He's dismissing it as a delusion, in a way. A very subtle delusion, but a delusion nevertheless. But basically he's saying it's not possible to give a systematic, philosophic or scientific account of reality. Reality is beyond and above any ideas about reality. And in our poetic version of the Heart Sutra, this statement is rendered as all things are by nature void. So the third statement of Avalokiteshvara is that in Shunyata no dharmas exist. So this just reiterates what's already been said, slightly different form. It's saying that reality is devoid of concepts and ideas. Reality is something other than anything we say or think about it. Yeah. And the fourth statement in the sutra takes various categories of Buddhist thought, various lists and so on, and it says there's nothing ultimately valid about any of them. Yeah. So again, this is similar to the other two statements. It's saying that all ideas, even Buddhist ideas, are not reality. They're not ends in themselves. The Dharma is a raft to cross to the other shore, or it's a finger pointing at the moon. It's not the other shore or the moon itself. What they are is another matter. And that can't be squeezed into any categories or lists. And the fifth statement says that one becomes a Buddha by relying on perfect wisdom. In other words, by having a direct experience of ultimate reality. And the sixth and last statement makes this the same point again, but makes it even more strongly by saying that all Buddhas, past, present and future, gain enlightenment through the development of perfect wisdom. And the sutra then ends with the perfection of wisdom mantra, Gate Gate Paragate Parasangate Bodhisvaha. And this mantra is related to the four levels of shunyata. So we come back to shunyata, which is what the perfection of wisdom is all about. I must say, I never found the teaching of shunyata at all helpful. Yeah? I've never found it helpful. Other people may find it helpful, but personally I never found it helpful. It just seemed another added complexity that was unnecessary. Yeah? And now, the reason for that is, of course, that Buddhism develops over centuries. So, as it develops over centuries, people need to refresh it and talk about it in different ways, as it were, and counteract errors that have crept in and so on. And so you get more and more conceptualization, more and more different kinds of language trying to explain the same thing. But when we come to it, because we've got access to the whole of the literature of early Buddhism and Mahayana Buddhism and Vajrayana Buddhism and so on, we've got access to all of that. We're encountering like this whole avalanche of ideas and so on. And it can become very complicated, and it can start to feel like you do need to have a kind of master's in Buddhism or something to understand what it's all about. But actually, it is much simpler than it seems if you just take all of that complexity, if you try to understand it, all of that. Even shunyata, in a way, is fairly simple. But first of all, just to give the more traditional thing. So the first gate of this gate gate refers to the first level of shunyata, which is called Sanskrita shunyata. Sanskrita means something that's put together, compounded, confected, put together. And it's usually means samsara. It's referring to samsara. So when they say Sanskrita shunyata, it means the emptiness of samsara. It means that samsara is empty of the characteristics of nirvana. Yeah. So the characteristics of enlightened existence are happiness, permanence, and ultimate reality. Whereas compounded or unenlightened existence is unsatisfactory, impermanent, and insubstantial. So this level of shunyata says that samsara is empty of nirvana. We cannot find in enlightened existence what only enlightenment can give us. Then the second level of shunyata is called asanskrita shunyata. So that's the emptiness of the uncompounded. The uncompounded basically is enlightened existence or nirvana. And basically the same point, just from the other side around. It's just saying nirvana is empty of samsara, enlightened existence is empty of the characteristics of unenlightened existence. There's no suffering, there's no impermanence, and there's no unreality in enlightened existence. Then the third level of shunyata is maha shunyata, the great emptiness. And this is the emptiness of any distinction between samsara and nirvana, between unenlightened existence and enlightened existence. It's saying that there's just one reality, yeah, not two realities. So this means that all dualities between enlightened and unenlightened, samsara and nirvana, are provisional. Yeah, they're pragmatic, but they're not ultimate. It's a kind of important point, but maybe not that easy to get sometimes. It's the difference between method and practice and statements about ultimate reality. And if you mix the two up, you can think that something which is about a method of practicing is a statement about ultimate reality, or something that's a statement about ultimate reality is about a method of practice. But sometimes they don't work like that. So it's important to know what's a practice, basically. Then the fourth level of shunyata is shunyata shunyata, so the emptiness of emptiness. And this basically is saying that emptiness itself, shunyata itself, is only a concept. Yeah, shunyata is an idea, it's a word that's pointing to something, it's hinting at something, but it's not the experience itself. In a way, that experience can't be described, it's beyond the reach of language. All that's left is silence. You might remember from your studies that at the end of, or in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, there's the thunderous silence. Vimalakirti is this thunderous silence. So that's what comes after the emptiness of emptiness, is the thunderous silence. Sangharakshita talks about this in What is the Dharma. He says, one may be as eloquent and insightful as one likes, but shunyata will always remain ultimately a mystery, even the greatest of all mysteries, so far as the Buddha's teaching is concerned. It cannot be explained or even described. So after all the words, we have silence. Yeah? After all the talk of shunyata, shunyata disappears like a bubble. And the perfection of wisdom literature is all about shunyata, and it's full of paradox. Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom, can't be packaged up in words and concepts. And I think that's why Prajnaparamita, the goddess, the bodhisattva, arose. Yeah? So although the perfection of wisdom literature is like a kind of, almost like a kind of anti-intellectual tour de force, as it were, nevertheless, it's still within that framework. It's within the framework of the intellect, as it were. Yeah? It's within that tradition. And it seems to me that what happens is that there are different kinds of people. There are those who go into the Dharma with their minds and study and analyze and so on and break through in that way. But there are other people who are full of faith, and their approach is much more via faith. When they encounter something like the perfection of wisdom, they take it at face value and worship it. Yeah, they worship the perfection of wisdom, whether it's the texts or whatever, they worship the perfection of wisdom. And when you start to worship, that worship then starts to take on the forms of images and so on. So the Vasantra refers to Prajnaparamita as the book that became a goddess. She's also known as the mother of all the Buddhas. So you can see how the mother of all the Buddhas and the perfection of wisdom are the same thing talked about in conceptual terms or in much more imaginative terms. You're talking about the mother of all the Buddhas, the goddess, the book who became a goddess. So Prajnaparamita is a Buddha or Bodhisattva in female form. But maybe before I say anything more about Prajnaparamita, just draw a few lessons from the different levels of shunyata. So the first two levels of shunyata talk about this distinction between samsara and nirvana, unenlightened existence and enlightened existence. And this, of course, is very necessary. We need to make this distinction. We need to think in this way for practical reasons. Yeah. If unenlightened existence is here and enlightened existence is over there, then we have to get from one to the other. And to get from one to the other, we need to take certain steps. We need to do certain things. We need to progress from here to there, from samsara to nirvana. So this is quite pragmatic and quite necessary. It's basically talking about the need to practice, the need to develop, the need to purify and so on. So it's talking about that movement. At least until such time as we have a more direct insight into reality. Of course, the danger with this is that we may become too goal-orientated, yeah? And we become too literal, and we think that enlightenment is literally over there, and we're here, and we have to get from here to there, yeah? So we think of nirvana as something to get to without actually changing ourselves, yeah? So the pursuit of nirvana, the pursuit of spiritual bliss, could become a substitute for real spiritual practice, yeah? So real spiritual practice involves greater and greater awareness of ourselves and of the rest of existence. So we need to become deeply aware of our motivations, even our motivation for our spiritual practice. We need to become deeply aware of the subtleties and nuances of our responses to other people, our responses to events, our responses to the Dharma. Yeah? We need to become deeply aware of the effect we have on the world and the effect that the world has on us. Yeah? We need to constantly probe deeper and develop more and more awareness. And in doing that, we're actually approaching nearer to reality. We're not chasing after reality as if it were something completely external to our life. And that's what the third level of shunyata is telling us. Nirvana is to be found in samsara. Unenlightened and enlightened existence inhabit the same reality. Or as the Song of Meditation says, apart from water, no ice. Outside living beings, no Buddhas. So the fourth level of shunyata is warning us against the dangers of literalism, the tendency of our rational minds to grasp concepts and fix them. So the perfection of wisdom literature is like a kind of crusade against literalism. Yeah. So we arrive at this emptiness of emptiness, this silence, yeah? The Dharma is always bigger than us, greater than our intellectual understanding. And of course, that's frustrating to our ego. But when the words run out, then an image arises. And it's this image. It's the image of a mature female figure, golden yellow in colour, wearing a tiara with jewels of five colours, the five colours of the five jhanas, five Buddhas. And she's seated in full lotus posture on a white moon mat in the centre of a blue lotus. And her hands are in the mudra of teaching the Dharma. And she holds a stem of a lotus in each hand, and the lotuses open out into blossoms at her shoulders, one at each shoulder. You have to imagine the yellow tulips as lotuses opening out. And resting on each lotus is a volume of the perfection of wisdom, and that's Prajnaparamita. There are other forms of Prajnaparamita, quite a number of different forms actually. Sometimes she's white in colour, and sometimes she has four arms, sometimes she has six arms, or even 11 arms. And she may also have a vajra in the four-armed form, she has a vajra in one of her hands. Sometimes she has a sword, the same sword that Manju Gosha has, the sword of wisdom. Yeah. Sometimes she has a mala and a begging bowl. And the mantra associated with Prajnaparamita, As I said earlier, it's different from the mantra at the end of the puja, the mantra at the end of the Heart Sutra. Although that mantra is also sometimes associated with Prajnaparamita. It's Om Adi Hung Swaha. It can't be translated into any conceptual idea. It's just syllables. It's simply the sound syllable, the sound symbol of the perfection of wisdom. In his book Meeting the Buddhas, Vasantras talks about Prajnaparamita. He refers to her as a goddess. And he says, regularly performing a sadhana of Prajnaparamita, so a meditation on Prajnaparamita, produces an ever-deepening involvement with the wisdom goddess. To start with, the goddess becomes a focus for devotion. For men, her practice can often absorb romantic and other feelings. For women, she's often a figure with which to identify, the most positive of all role models. Thus, for both sexes, energy can be easily engaged by the meditation, and hence poured into the contemplation of wisdom. If this process continues, the practice enters the realm of the archetypal. Prajnaparamita is the wisdom goddess of India, once described as staggeringly beautiful to the point of being scorching. Her meditation can become a way of experiencing the archetypal beauty of the refined levels of one's mind. Finally, with faithful practice, she can become far more than that. She can become the experience of transcendental wisdom, the transcendence of the world of subject and object. So that's what Vasantra says in Meeting the Buddhas. There's a lot more about Prajnaparamita in Meeting the Buddhas, so if you want to follow up, you could read some more there. So I'm going to finish shortly because we're getting on. I just want to repeat a couple of points which have come up. Firstly, the perfect wisdom or enlightenment is not a rational experience. It's not a matter of gaining knowledge or getting our ideas right. Yeah? It's something else. You could say it's a direct face-to-face experience with Prajnaparamita. And awareness is the key to unlock the mysteries of this experience. In a way, to make it a bit more simple, in a way we all have some realization of wisdom, because we all have to some degree embodied something of our values, of the dharmic values. Yeah. So it's not that we have no experience at all of what awakened consciousness might be like. It's just that we haven't actually perfected it. We're not fully there. But most of us who are practicing, we've gone beyond purely intellectual understanding of the Dharma, because we're practicing. We have experiential knowledge of the Dharma as well as purely intellectual understanding. So if you're practicing, you've gone some way. It's a bit like that first thing of call forth as much as you can. If you can also call forth as much as you can of wisdom, or call forth as much as you can of compassion, because it's already there. You've already, to some degree, embodied that because you're practicing. Yeah. Then wisdom and compassion are not different. That was the other thing that came up. When perfect wisdom acts, that activity is compassionate. When perfect wisdom speaks, the words are compassionate. It can't be otherwise. And just to come right back down to the level of day-to-day practice, I think there are two things that we can usefully do in order to develop wisdom and compassion. And the first thing is not to identify with our moods. Yeah? Our moods are passing things. And to develop insight into the self, as it were, as a process of change, we need to let go of identifying with moods and not take our ups and downs too seriously. In a way, not take too seriously our centrality in the universe, yeah? Mm-hmm. Which is where we're often spinning around this experience of being the centre of the universe. But you know, you can carry on doing that, but don't take it too seriously. You know? And in this way, we can gradually develop wisdom. Wisdom is quite fun, even funny. Yeah. So it's not something to be too frightened of. And the second thing we can do is practice generosity. In a way, that's the most basic spiritual practice, and it's the beginnings of compassion, and it's the end of compassion, generosity. We need to practice generosity in the small things in order to cultivate the mind of compassion. And the mind of compassion is concerned with the spiritual welfare of everybody. So we need to cultivate generosity, because generosity takes us out of ourselves, makes us at least for a while think of others, and that is the road, as it were, the whole direction of compassion. So, call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. Remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. Listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, taught for the weal of the world, for heroic spirits intended.